I'm going to introduce the first speaker now. His name is Kip Thorne, and he's the Feynman Professor of Theoretical Physics at the California Institute of Technology. Kip is probably well known to a lot of you. He's one of the leading researchers in general relativity on the planet. Something that he's been involved in recently is he's a strong advocate for the building of large observatories for the detection, for the very first time, of ripples in space-time, which are we call gravitational waves, and which are a prediction of Einstein's theory of general relativity. Kip has authored a number of books on general relativity, including one of the classic graduate-level textbooks in the subject. It was the textbook that I used when I was a graduate student to learn general relativity. And more recently, he's written a popular level book, which many of you, I suspect, have read, called Black Holes and Time Warps, Einstein's Outrageous Legacy. Kip is going to start off our conference by telling us about black holes, their properties, and behavior.
I can't imagine anybody being intimidated by me, so I think that's not a worry. I'm going to move this out to the side so I can slip in here. Let me begin by giving you an outline of where I'm going. I'm going to begin briefly by talking about black holes from the point of view of Newton's theory of gravity. They were called dark stars by people in the late 1700s, 1800s, and were briefly fashionable, and then disappeared from the ideas of theoretical physicists until general relativity came along, and a radically different version of a dark star or black hole was conceived within general relativity. So I will then talk about general relativity, and I will describe relativity and how it characterizes gravity as being due to a warpage or curvature of space-time. Then I will talk about the implosion of a star to form a black hole, and next about the details of the space-time curvature or warpage around a black hole. I'll focus in considerable detail on the effects of the spin of a black hole. They will play a major role in the subsequent discussion by Roger Blanford of observational aspects of black holes. Then I will go on and talk about the birth and growth of the event horizon of a black hole, how the laws that govern how the horizon evolves, then talk about what's inside a black hole, about gravitational waves, which are intimately connected with the theory of black holes, finally, a few words about some exotica that are unlikely to exist in the universe, but we cannot 100% rule out: naked singularities, wormholes, and time machines. So let me begin with a description of what black holes look like according to Newton's laws of gravity. The original work on the theory of black holes in Newton's theory, within the framework of Newton's laws of gravity, was by a British natural philosopher, as they called him at that time, named John Mitchell, in 1793, who described these dark stars in the following way. This is a slightly more modern way of saying what was essentially what he said in his publication. Suppose that you have a star that has a mass m and a radius r, and let's suppose that the radius has managed somehow to become smaller than a certain critical size, which is 2 times Newton's gravitation constant times the mass of the star divided by the speed of light squared. That is a formula that we will encounter time and again as we discuss black holes. It arises in the framework of general relativity as well as in Newton's laws of gravity. And so it's worth remembering that number of the size of this critical radius. It's 3 kilometers for the critical radius times the mass of the black hole in units of the mass of the sun. So for the Earth, the critical radius would be something of order a centimeter. The statement is that if the radius of the star becomes smaller than this critical radius, then light will be trapped by the gravitational pull of the star. Now, of course, to talk about light being trapped, people working within the framework of Newton's laws had to have some way to describe light. And in this period, around 1793, they were taking an approach to the description of light that was advocated by Newton himself earlier, in which light consisted of corpuscles or particles that would be launched at some particular speed, but that presumably would suffer a slowdown under the gravitational pull of the star, just in the same way that any other kind of a particle emitted off the surface of a star would. And so if we imagine a particle of light, a corpuscle, it has a mass m and is launched at the speed c, that is the standard speed of light that we're accustomed to, then it will have an energy at the time that it's launched of one, according to Newton, of one half its mass times its speed squared. But then there will be a gravitational potential energy that's minus Newton's gravitation constant, the product of the masses divided by the radius at which it's launched. It will fly outward with this energy conserved, slowing down its speed as its gravitational potential energy becomes less negative, until it reaches a highest point, a maximum radius, at which its speed has sunk to zero, and its energy then is minus g times the product of the masses divided by that maximum radius. And so if you equate these two energies to each other, you find that they and do just a little bit of algebra, you find that the maximum radius that it can reach is the radius of the black hole divided by this difference. And so that's a little larger than the radius of the black hole. And if the radius of the black hole is small, if the radius of the black hole is close to the critical radius, then it can get almost all the way out because this denominator becomes close to zero. So that was the story of what a black hole would look like in Newton's laws. You would have the star sitting here emitting all this light. The light particles would fly up and fall back, fly up and fall back. And if you and I had a rocket ship with enough fuel, with high enough efficiency, we could fly down here. We couldn't see the star. We could tell it had a gravitational pull, but we could fly down in our rocket ship, get low enough inside this maximum radius, and then we'd see the star, descend even all the way to the surface of the star, explore what's going on with the star, and then climb back out and go back to Earth and report, this is what things are like inside a black hole. So that was Newton's that's what black holes would be like if Newton's laws of gravity were correct. However, they are not correct, and it was Einstein, of course, who first realized that they cannot be correct, because Einstein, in 1905, formulated the laws of special relativity and then had the audacity to insist that nature surely must obey the fundamental principle that all the laws of physics have got to be compatible with his special laws of relativity. And he then looked around and said, well, look, Newton's laws of gravity are not compatible with my laws of special relativity, so they must be wrong, and Einstein was correct. Why are they not compatible with his laws of special relativity? Well, one of the consequences of special relativity is that distances depend on the reference frame in which you measure them. They are relative in that sense. So if you have a particle, or let's say a planet outside the sun, and you measure the gravitational acceleration between that planet and the sun, that gravitational acceleration, according to Newton's laws, will be minus g times the mass of the sun divided by the distance squared to the planet, times a unit vector pointing in the radial direction. But the issue is, in whose reference frame is this radius to be measured? Is it the reference frame of the sun? The planet, of course, is in orbit around the sun. Is it the reference frame of the planet? Is it the reference frame of the center of mass? And Newton's laws of gravity make no distinction between reference frames. They're incompatible with the idea that there is any ambiguity at all about that distance. Similarly, one may ask, in what direction does the gravitational acceleration point? So we can do a thought experiment in which we have the sun here, and at some particular moment of time, a very advanced civilization grabs the sun and moves it at nearly the speed of light to this location, and then sets it down again. Now, the laws of special relativity insist that no signal, no information can propagate faster than the speed of light. So let's imagine a burst of light that's emitted from the location, the initial location of the sun, right at the moment immediately before this advanced civilization moves the sun. Then by the time that the sun has been moved and is at rest here, come to rest here, that burst of light is at this location. Somebody at that out here doesn't know that the sun has been moved because there was inadequate time for the information to reach them. And so the person right here will say, well, the direction in which the gravitational acceleration points is toward there. But a person just inside this velocity of light circle knows the sun has moved, and so the gravitational acceleration is in that direction. And clearly this is ludicrous, that nothing at all like this is allowed in Newton's laws of gravity. Just don't account for that kind of a possibility. So it was unequivocal that there was a fundamental incompatibility between Newton's laws and Einstein's special theory of relativity. And so Einstein, recognizing this incompatibility, struggled between 1907 and 1915 to formulate a new description of gravity that would be compatible with and mesh in a very nice manner with the laws of special relativity. And this was part then of the first great revolution in our understanding of the laws of nature in the 20th century, the relativity revolution. The second great revolution was the quantum mechanics revolution, and Professor Polchinski will be talking about that revolution and its consequences for our modern understanding of the laws of gravity later on today. Einstein, from that period of about a decade, struggling with the issue of what is the nature of gravity, came to the conclusion that gravity must be associated with a warpage of space and time, that space and time are warped by any matter or energy that are around in the space-time, and that this warpage is responsible for gravity. Now, this is a radical change of viewpoint about the nature of gravity, and of course it was not readily and quickly accepted, and it was also not easy to test. It was not until the 1970s that technology got to the point where high-accuracy tests could be done. Among the first really high-accuracy tests was a test of the warpage of time, warpage of the rate of flow of time, by massive bodies, in particular by the Earth. And the statement is that the flow of time, according to general relativity, should be slowed near the Earth or any other massive body. And so on June 18, 1976, NASA flew a spacecraft called Gravity Probe A, the first of what will be ultimately a series of spacecraft to test Einstein's ideas about the nature of gravity. Flew this spacecraft up in a suborbital flight to a height of 10,000 kilometers. That's about something like 1.5 Earth radii, approximately. And then it just fell back down into the ocean. That rocket carried several atomic clocks. And back down at Cape Kennedy, at the Kennedy Space Center at Cape Canaveral, there were another set of atomic clocks. And signals, radio signals, were telemetered down from the spacecraft to the Earth to compare the ticking rates of the clocks in the rocket and the clocks down on the surface of the Earth. The prediction was that time should flow faster at the top of the orbit than on the surface of the Earth by about 4 parts in 10 to the 10, or about 1 second in each 1,000 years. The clocks had an accuracy over that time interval of about 3 parts in 10 to the 14, and there was a beautiful agreement between theory and experiment confirming to an accuracy of about 1 part in 10,000 that time really is slowed down near the surface of the Earth compared to what it is up at high above the surface of the Earth. The 1970s also brought us the first really high precision tests of the idea that space should be warped by massive bodies, in this case, space around the sun. So if we take the sun and we imagine taking an equatorial slice through the sun, one might have expected that to have the geometry of a flat sheet of paper, a Euclidean geometry. But in fact, because, according to Einstein, space around the sun is warped, then the geometry that you would measure on this sheet of paper violates Euclid's axioms. The sum of the interior angles of a triangle is bigger than 180 degrees in that geometry, for example. Initially, parallel lines that are straight lines wind up crossing. And in fact, then, if you imagine embedding that two-dimensional geometry of that equatorial slice in a flat surrounding space, then in order for it to fit into the flat surrounding space, it has to assume a shape that looks like this. You can think about that flat surrounding space in two ways. You can imagine actually pulling this equatorial slice out, maintaining its intrinsic geometry, that sheet, pull it out and take it out into interstellar space and look at it and see how it's bent. Or you can alternatively imagine that our universe, in which space is warped, is embedded in some higher dimensional universe, which is often called hyperspace, even by professional physicists as well as science fiction writers. And you can imagine that you are a higher dimensional being who can look in and see from hyperspace what our universe looks like, and then this is what that slice would look like as seen from hyperspace. The key point is that the circumference around the sun is less than pi times the diameter, and so you have a bowl-shaped geometry in what is called then an embedding diagram that embeds the geometry of this equatorial slice in a flat surrounding space. Now, the first really high-precision test of this was a test carried out by Erwin Shapiro and colleagues, in which they, in which in 1976 there was a Viking spacecraft on the surface of Mars and another Viking spacecraft in orbit around Mars. And Mars and the Earth in their orbits carried the line of sight between them such that it nearly passed through the sun. And so there was a nearly grazing incidence of the path along which radio signals send out from Earth to Mars and then return along which those radio signals traveled. And so the distance between Earth and Mars was monitored by sending out radio signals that had a code encoded on them, a digital code on the radio signals. And what was measured was the time that it took for that code to go out and come back. The added distance that was predicted by Einstein's laws of general relativity for the signal that went from the Earth to Mars, the added distance beyond what it should have been if space had been flat in here, was about 37 kilometers out of a total round trip travel time of 378 million kilometers. And the measurements had an accuracy of about 37 meters, and so to a precision of about a part in a thousand, it was confirmed not only that the prediction was correct for the extra distance traveled along this path, but the whole sequence of paths as Mars and Earth moved relative to each other, and these paths went close to the sun and farther away. So a beautiful mapping out of the curve of what that distance should look like as a function of time as the Earth and Mars moved in their orbits. So these were unequivocal demonstrations that space and time are warped, at least in the solar system. Not strongly warped, but warped by enough to be measured with high precision by the technology of the 1970s. We heard at this conference the reports as yet unpublished of new experiments that have improved the accuracies on the measurements of the warpage around the sun by another factor of 10 recently, and it will be published shortly. So technology marches on. Let me now turn to the issue of the implosion of a star to form a black hole and the space-time warpage that one encounters in such an implosion. This and some of the other drawings are taken from my book, Black Holes and Time Warps, and I'm indebted to Matthew Zimmett, a wonderful artist, for drawing these very nice little diagrams. This depicts the curvature of space in what I like to call the parable of the ants. The depiction of the curvature of space is really a fairly accurate depiction, but it's a story that I like to tell, in which there is a family of ants get together for a family conference in the center, and they just have too much mass, and they trigger space to begin to collapse in the form of black hole. There is an astronomer ant, a particularly intelligent ant out here, who has built a signal ball telescope and can receive signal balls that are sent out by the ants in the family conference to tell the astronomer what's going on. And so these signal balls are sent out one after another at equally spaced intervals of time. And as time passes, the space in which the ants live, which we can think of as a rubber membrane in this two-dimensional analog, it begins to bend down as a result of the mass of the ants having become very concentrated toward the center, and space is beginning to collapse to form a black hole. And the signal balls roll out. Now, two things are going on here that also go on in the case of a real collapse, of a real star to form a black hole. Space is becoming more and more highly curved in the region where the ants are, or inside and near the collapsing star. But space is also, relative to hyperspace, relative to you and I as higher dimensional beings looking in from hyperspace, space is sliding inward at the same time. The signal balls travel at a unique speed, the speed of light, relative to space, but you and I out here in hyperspace see that space is sliding in, the signal balls are traveling out, and because space is sliding in, the signal balls get farther and farther apart as they travel outward, because this signal ball is trying to travel out against a more rapid inflow of space than that signal ball is trying to deal with. And so ultimately the time comes when there's a point in this inflow of space where the space is flowing in at the speed of light. Signal ball number 15 becomes trapped and spins its wheels sitting at this location, and all other signal balls get caught up along with the ants, squeezed and destroyed in a singularity of space and time, which I will talk a little bit more about later. And thereafter, the astronomer ant sees signal ball 14 come in, much later signal ball 14.999, but can never ever see any signal balls emitted at number 15 or later. And so there is a bit of information that this astronomer ant can receive, and can never ever learn anything about what's going on down in this region, which has now become the interior of a black hole, or the singularity where the ants were already all destroyed. So that's the story of the black hole formation in this parable.
Are the times significant that you have with this?
The times are not terribly significant. I will give you times, real times. The times, in fact, will depend upon the mass of the collapsing star. And so I will give you real times in a few minutes. It is said that if any physicist wants to identify another physicist, you just utter the number 137. I was met by somebody I had never ever seen before at the Indianapolis airport a few weeks ago, and they had a big sign that said nothing but 137. So yeah, it had something to do with that, but just for sociological reasons. Okay. Okay. So let's talk about this getting just a little bit more realistic. So I am over here talking about how things would see ignoring the curvature of space with the equatorial slice through here. I imagine photons emitted from the surface of the collapsing star, the imploding star, and there is a critical circumference at which that signal ball 15 gets trapped or at which any outgoing light would get trapped and beyond which we can't see anything. That critical circumference in general relativity turns out to be given by the formula 2 pi times the same formula as Mitchell had derived using Newton's laws of gravity back in 1793. So the critical circumference for formation of a black hole, this is in the case of a non-spinning star forming a non-spinning black hole. We'll talk about spin a little bit later. That critical circumference is 2 pi times 3 kilometers times the mass in units of the mass of the sun. I'm going to define, for purposes of discussing black holes, a radius that I will use over and over again, a radius which actually is the critical circumference divided by 2 pi. And you have to keep reminding yourself that's not the radius that you would measure if you went down inside and marched through and saw the distance from the center to the surface. It's the circumference divided by 2 pi. Okay. Now, in this implosion of the star to form a black hole, as photons are emitted and travel outward, they suffer a gravitational redshift. They lose energy because they're traveling out from a very deep gravitational potential well. But whereas in Newton's laws of gravity, that means they would slow down their propagation speed, not so in general relativity or special relativity. According to relativity and according to Maxwell's equations, the photons, or the light that travels out, simply get shifted redward in wavelength, shifted to lower frequencies, longer wavelengths, but continues to propagate always at the speed of light relative to any local inertial frame of some freely falling observer who's down here near where the photon is, say near the horizon of the black hole. So it's always traveling at the same speed as you would measure locally if you sat there and looked at it, in the same sense as the signal balls were moving at this unique speed of light relative to space that was sliding in. Well, relative to local inertial frames means is the analog of relative to the sliding space. That doesn't mean that the photons get out easily, because it's seen from the point of view of hyperspace, some higher dimensional being who can see the warpage of space, they're having a heck of a time getting out. But relative to any measurement that we would make near the horizon or near where the black hole is forming, if we were there making measurements and falling in as we watch the light traveling out, falling freely, the light would always travel at the speed of light. But it would get shifted redward in frequency. So that the frequency that is ultimately received by a distant observer divided by the frequency of the light that is emitted is given by the product of two terms. One is a Doppler shift, just because the surface of the star is shrinking, smaller and smaller. So you imagine that the surface is shrinking, and let's suppose that I am at rest in the external gravitational field just above the surface of the star, and it's receding from me very fast because it's shrinking. I'm blasting my rocket engines to prevent myself from falling in after the star. And I just look at the light, and I see the light is redshifted because of the Doppler shift. By the square root of 1 plus the velocity with which the star is receding from me just below my feet divided by the speed of light, and 1 minus V over C. So that gets me from the wavelength of the light that is emitted on the surface of the star to the wavelength that I would measure if I'm blasting my rocket ship but am just immediately above the star's surface. Then the light has to crawl out of the gravitational potential well of the star, and there's an additional gravitational redshift that goes like 1 over 1 minus the circumference at which I am sitting and which the star is located as it goes flying past me, divided by the critical circumference. So there are two factors. If you go and look in my book in these drawings, only the gravitational redshift factor is included. When you include both factors for a realistic collapsing star, and then you ask, what is the wavelength of the light look like as seen by a distant observer out here who watches with his watch or a high-precision atomic clock, watches the time and measures the wavelength of the light coming out, the light is exponentially redshifted in time as measured by this distant observer. With an E-folding time for the wave, this should be e to the plus, okay? So an e-folding time for the wavelength to get longer and longer that is 4gm over c cubed, where m is the mass of the collapsing star, that's 20 microseconds times the mass in units of the mass of the sun. That is an awfully short e-folding time. So if there were no gunk around hiding this collapse from you, if there was no other material that had been thrown off and is obscuring your vision, you would see the light from the star dim out and go black, becoming redder and redder and redder at very late times, becoming smaller by a factor of, or redder by a factor of about 2 every 20 microseconds. So like that, it's gone. And there's no more light. It's absolutely black. Now suppose that you were down, riding down with the star or hovering in a spaceship above the star. What do you see? So you look out at the stars above, and the light comes down, being pulled down gravitationally by the collapsing star's gravitational pull. The light rays are deflected by the gravitational pull, or put differently, they are deflected, they are bent, their trajectory is distorted by the warpage of space and time around the collapsing star. And so that this light ray, which if you traced it back, would have come from somewhere down there. This light ray comes down and is seen at the edge of a brilliant patch above yourself. You see basically a bright patch that is all the light coming from the exterior universe. But if you're looking out in this direction, you're looking at a light ray that if you were to track it back, would have had to come out of the star. So all you can see of the external universe is a bright patch overhead. Suppose that you go down with the star through the critical circumference into the interior. Light can still get in. Light can't get out, but light can get in. You would still see the same thing. You can see the external universe. You see this bright patch overhead of light from coming from all the stars in the heavens, all concentrated into a bright patch overhead. No problem seeing out if you're inside. But if we're on the outside, we can't see in. That's the nature of the space-time warpage around the black hole.
Would you be able to see individual stars, or would you just see a single bright patch?
You would see individual stars. In fact, you would see several images of each individual star. Suppose that we talk about a star that is located directly overhead. So you see an image of that star that's right in the center here. But if you look out here, that light ray may have come around and come in from that same star. So you see that same star over here. And similarly, this light ray may have come around and come from the same star as well. And so you see that same star over here.
And what would it look like if you were 6 feet to the left, or 3 inches to the left, or 6 millimeters to the left?
So you mean if you move here?
Yeah.
Well, suppose you're over here. You're seeing things that come down from here. The locations of the various stars on the, here are changed.
The only thing you can see is directly opposite solar gravity. Everything
seems to be concentrated directly opposite, but you see every star in the heavens in multiple images. If you're here, you pick any star in the heaven and you will see it, a primary image, say, there. You'll see a secondary image here, a tertiary, fourth, fifth, sixth, and similarly going out there with these images piling up at the rim of this disk. Yeah. And so how much blue shift or red shift they may have will depend on what you're doing. They will typically be blue shifted, yes. If you're blasting your rocket ship to prevent yourself from falling in, they'll be strongly blue shifted. If you're falling in, they'll be less strongly blue shifted. So it depends on how you're moving. Similarly, the size of this disk will depend on how you're moving. If you're blasting your rocket ship to prevent yourself from falling in, it'll have a different size than if you're falling directly in. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so if another star falls with you through the event horizon right over here, you can watch it all the way down as you go. Yes. Yes, one more question. Yes. So suppose that somebody outside watches you descend. And suppose you're just falling freely, then they see a similar thing to what we saw with the star that's imploding. They can't see anything that is emitted after you go through the horizon. And the duration between receipt of individual photons gets longer and longer. So they see you seem to hover and become frozen just above the horizon. And you seem to become frozen, but you become black like that. Remember, this is 20 microseconds for the light to go out. So the light goes out on you, apparently frozen at the horizon. This is all an optical illusion, of course. It's just because the light has such difficulty getting out that that's what it looks like to the external observer. To anybody in your vicinity watching you, everything is just perfectly normal as you and they fall through. Yes? When I say the light freezes, what I mean is you seem to... Let me back down. Where are you? What do I... Okay, so you're outside watching me fall in. All you see me seem to freeze at the horizon. I seem to slow down. It's an optical illusion because the light is having such a struggle to get out. What I see is absolutely everything is completely normal. I just go flying on through the horizon and into my fate.
But does it actually freeze, or does it reach
it actually stop? The outside observer can't see after a few milliseconds because it's all become black. There's no more light to come out and tell him anything. So you seem to have frozen. And then the last photon, remember the light that is emitted is in discrete photons. And the last photon comes out, no more photons, no more information. The last that the external person could see was you seem to have become frozen there, but no more information available.
It
terminates because the last bit of light came out, the last photon came out, then there's no way to get any further information. Yes? You have this exponentially growing redshift, which you would not have in that case. So it just becomes redder and redder in 20 microseconds. Just remember that number for one solar mass. That's very fast reddening, and it just keeps going until the last photon is out. So is there lower energy photons that you wouldn't see as that redshift gets longer and longer? It gets a little, as soon as the photon, yes, until the photons have a wavelength comparable to the size of the star, or it's comparable to the size of the collapsed star, the critical radius. Then the photons get caught by the curved space-time geometry and they can't propagate as photons anymore. And so they can't even get out. And they start behaving as trapped waves instead of behaving as discrete photons. And so that's an added complication that we normally don't talk about. Yes.
Is the idea of seeing multiple images of the stars, is that the idea of gravitational lensing?
That is one aspect of gravitational lensing. Similarly, in gravitational lensing, you see multiple images without having to get down close to the horizon. You still see multiple images. Professor Blanford, who will be the next speaker, is one of the world's great experts on that, and so you can ask him. Let me move on. The space-time warpage around a black hole is actually rather rich and complicated, rather more than what I've described thus far. There are actually three aspects to that warpage or curvature of space-time. One is the curvature of space, which we've been talking about in terms of embedding diagrams, that the circumference around the critical, around the black hole at any location near the black hole, circumference is much less than pi times diameter. So that's the first effect, and that shows up in the embedding diagram. The second effect is a warpage of time. Time slows near the black hole in the same way as it slows near the surface of the Earth, but ever so much more. And, of course, as you might expect, right at the horizon, time has slowed to a crawl. The horizon is the modern name for the critical circumference, the point out of which beyond which light can't travel. So time slows here in the sense that if you hover above the horizon blasting your rockets to prevent yourself from falling in, and then you measure the rate of flow of time as seen by yourself, and the rate of flow of time that I see far away, and we do that measurement by sending light signals back and forth, time down here, we will agree that time down here is slowed enormously, in fact, infinitely right at the critical circumference or at the horizon relative to time far away. That's a slowing of time, a relative time, is seen by two observers, both of whom are at rest with respect to each other, one immediately above the horizon and the other very far away. Well, what about time when you get inside the horizon? In a sense that I will explain a little more deeply in a few minutes, time inside the horizon flows downward. It flows in what you would have thought was a spatial direction, but it flows downward. And it is the fact that nothing can move backward in time, at least locally like this, nothing can move backward in time that enforces the inability of anything to get out because time is flowing downward and so nothing can emerge back through the critical circumference or the horizon. Everything is dragged forward in time, which means down toward the center, at a center, a singularity that I will talk about in a few minutes. So that's the second aspect of the warpage of space-time, the warping of time. And then there's a third aspect, that a black hole in general is spinning. There are two major conservation laws involved in black hole physics for big black holes. One is the conservation of mass, that says that the mass of the black hole will be the same as the mass of the star that collapsed to form it. What do I mean by mass? I mean by mass the mass that you would measure by applying Kepler's laws to planets that are in orbit around the black hole. So you have a star, it's going to collapse to form a black hole, you look at a distant planet, apply Kepler's laws, and measure the mass. That's how we measure the mass of the Sun, after all, is by applying Kepler's laws to the Earth's orbit and to Mercury's orbit, the other planetary orbits. The star collapses to form a black hole, we look at that same planet, apply Kepler's laws, we get the same mass. And so the mass resides then in the black hole, unchanged from what it was for the star. Similarly, the angular momentum tied up in the star's spin can be measured by the fact that near the star, there is for typical stars, a very small dragging of space into rotational motion around the star, which shows up experimentally in the sense that if you were to fly a very high-precision gyroscope, inertial gyroscope, in orbit near the star, that inertial gyroscope, instead of pointing out at the very distant galaxies, fixed always pointing toward the very distant galaxies or quasars, it will precess because the space in which it is residing is being dragged into motion around the star by the spin of the star. And as the star shrinks, that spin angular momentum of the star that causes the precession of the gyroscope, it remains conserved. And after the black hole forms, space is still being dragged in that same manner into this sort of tornado-like motion around then the horizon. And so if you look at the angular velocity with which space is being dragged, it's small at large radii. As you get down closer and closer to the horizon, it's faster and faster, and there is some critical angular velocity at the horizon that is a measure of how fast the black hole is spinning. And it's an angular velocity of dragging of space into tornado-like motion. Yes? If you are hovering right above the horizon, immediately above the horizon, you can watch the entire future history of the universe flash by. Okay. What do you want? So in principle, if you want to travel forward in time very fast, you descend, hover above the horizon of a black hole, and then come back out. And a billion years have passed in the external universe, but you've only lived for a year or whatever, in principle. In practice, there are a few technological problems. Okay. Now, once the star has imploded to form the black hole, then the material has actually gone inside the black hole. It was an optical illusion that it was freezing at the horizon. It goes inside the black hole down to the center where, as I will discuss in a few minutes, there is a space-time singularity and the material gets destroyed. And so it's interesting to ask, what is the black hole made of? It's not made from the matter of the star that formed it, because that matter has been destroyed and is now in some new form that's governed by the laws of quantum gravity that Professor Polchinski will tell you about. The black hole itself is made from the very warpage of space and time that I've been talking about, and made from nothing else. And you might ask, how is it possible that you can have a black hole that's made from a warpage of space and time, when I asserted at the beginning of this discussion that warpage of space and time are caused by matter and energy? Well, they are caused by matter and energy, that's right. And this simple Newtonian discussion will illustrate the fact that, in fact, you could have such energy present in the black hole without having matter. Let's talk about having a planet here, a very advanced civilization, that builds a little girder work structure here and a circular platform, and then increases the mass of the planet by lowering down an additional mass, delta M, and laying it as a thin layer on this platform. And you can ask ourselves now, what is the new mass of this planet? As seen in the way we always measure mass in relativity, and seen by applying Kepler's laws to distant planets, or in this case, a distant moon in orbit around this planet. The total mass of the planet, so augmented, is the original mass plus the mass you added on, but then you have to remember that there was a gravitational potential energy of this added on mass in the gravitational field of the original planet's mass. And that's minus g times the product of the two masses divided by the radius of the planet. That's an energy. Energy and mass are equivalent, according to Einstein, so you divide by the speed of light squared to turn that into a mass, and this is actually the mass of the new planet. That's the mass that you would measure by applying Kepler's laws to some distant moon. And you notice that the mass then has a contribution from gravity. That is, gravity generates gravity. But gravity, according to Einstein, is really just a curvature of space and time. So a curvature of space-time can generate curvature of space-time. This is a nonlinearity in Einstein's equations of general relativity. And that nonlinearity is of the utmost strength in a black hole, where the black hole is made from a curvature of space-time. But that curvature of space-time is generated by the curvature's own energy. And so the curvature of space-time has energy. That energy creates the very curvature of space-time that had the energy. And the whole thing holds together in the form of what is sometimes in other fields of physics called a soliton, or it's an entity that holds itself together by virtue of its own energy, without the presence of any matter whatsoever. Let me talk now for a little bit about the spin of the black hole, which will be quite important in Professor Blanford's talk. So let's suppose we have a black hole with spin angular momentum that I'll denote J sub H. Conservation of angular momentum, as I told you before, says that this is the total angular momentum that has gone into that black hole in the past in the form of angular momentum of the star that collapsed to form it and angular momentum of anything else that ever fell in. We, in relativity, generally talk about the spin of the black hole or its angular momentum in terms of a dimensionless parameter that is the angular momentum of the black hole divided by the mass of the black hole squared, and then the speed of light squared Newton's gravitation constant in that ratio to make this dimensionless. And Einstein's equations insist that the black hole always has this spin parameter between 0 and 1 and can never get bigger than 1. And Roy Kerr, a mathematician from New Zealand, in 1963 derived the equations that describe quiescent black holes that have settled down into an equilibrium state, and that equations that show that the what all the properties of the black hole are in terms of its mass and its spin parameter. And the fact that all properties of the black hole are determined for astrophysical black holes in terms of the mass and the spin parameter. If you have microscopic black holes that show up in quantum gravity, you can have additional parameters called charges that Polchinski may talk about, I don't know. But for astrophysical black holes, it's really just the mass and the spin parameter. That fact is known under the phrase that a black hole has no hair, but in fact, the correct phrase should be a black hole has two hairs, its mass and its spin, and all other properties are determined by those two hairs. So you can write down a beautiful set of formulae which will appear on transparency, on my transparencies, that say, for example, the angular velocity of the horizon as it spins around, the angular velocity with which space is dragged, is given by this formula in terms of the spin parameter and the mass of the black hole. But that angular velocity of dragging is about 10 to the 5 radians per second for a rapidly spinning black hole that has the mass of the sun. Black holes spin fast. That's approximately 1 over that E-folding rate for light to redshift as it is emitted by an observer falling into a black hole. Well, how does this spin manifest itself? It manifests itself in the following way, that if we have a particle that falls into a black hole and the black hole is spinning, the spin of the black hole drags space into a rotational motion around the horizon. Space drags the particle, and the particle, as it falls in, has to whirl around and around. As it nears the horizon, it moves in lockstep with the horizon, being dragged by the spin of space with this angular velocity that is in typically many, many revolutions per second. And if you try to throw that particle in the opposite direction to prevent it from being dragged in this manner, it will come in and get whipped back around. And as it nears the horizon, it whirls around at the angular velocity of the horizon. It has no way to avoid doing that. Now, the the radius of the horizon is defined in terms of the circumference over 2 pi, is given as promised by a formula in terms of the mass and the spin parameter. The interesting thing is that if the black hole is rapidly spinning, 2 things happen. It gets physically smaller for its mass, so its radius is 1.5 kilometers instead of 3 kilometers, and it gets centrifugally flattened, just as a spinning planet will get centrifugally flattened in that manner. It will have a surface area, given also in terms then of the mass and the spin parameter. And the surface area turns out to be a critical element in the theory of black holes, because, as Professor Polchinski will discuss, the surface area turns out to be the entropy of a black hole in disguise, or the amount of information that's been lost down the black hole in disguise. And he will explain to us why that is, and how the great triumph of string theory in the last few years has been to explain why that is. So fortunately, I don't have to discuss that. A black hole has an enormous amount of rotational energy tied up in its spin in the vicinity of the black hole in this tornado-like motion of the space. Again, a rotational energy that you can express in terms of the mass and the spin parameter that works out for a rapidly spinning black hole to be 29% of the mass of the black hole times the speed of light squared. 5 times 10 to the 46 joules if you have a one solar mass black hole. And it's interesting to compare that with the amount of nuclear energy that is available inside the sun to keep the solar system warm in the entire life of the solar system, which is about 0.001 times the mass of the sun squared. This is about roughly 300 times better at storing energy in spin of a black hole than storing it in nuclear energy. And thus it is, and it turns out, as Professor Blanford will discuss, that black holes and the energy tied up in their spins is likely to be the source of energy for the most powerful violent events in the universe. Now let me talk just a bit about the creation and growth of the horizon of a black hole. I'm going to now give a different way of depicting the space-time curvature around a black hole in terms of space-time diagrams. So I'll draw time up and plot space horizontally. I have an imploding star. At some particular moment of time, the star is the interior of a circle here because I have suppressed one spatial dimension. And I'm not showing the curvature of this space, but I am plotting correctly the circumference around the center. So I'm plotting circumferences correctly, and the time lapse is seen by a distant observer correctly, and none of the other warpage is correctly described. And that's why, although the light travels at precisely the uniform speed, the speed of light is seen physically by any observer in here, in this diagram, a physical observer, in this diagram, you see light that is emitted from this location seeming to travel more slowly than the speed of light, trying to climb out. It's more slowly just because I haven't shown you this strong warpage of space in there. But this enables you to see what goes on in the following sense, that we can ask what regions of the universe can be seen by a distant observer. Distant observer up here looks down to try to study what's going on in the collapsing star that forms the black hole, sees by means of this light ray, follow the light ray back. The light ray moved along that trajectory, and so the distant observer can see this region of space-time, but there's a region that cannot be seen. That's the region where light has been totally trapped, and that's the interior of the horizon. The horizon is born at the center of the collapsing star, and it grows as time passes, until it emerges from the surface of the collapsing star, and then the circumference and surface area of the horizon become frozen thereafter until new material falls in and the horizon grows larger. The surface area of the horizon, according to the second law of black hole mechanics, due to Stephen Hawking, the surface area of the horizon can never decrease. And that turns out to be a statement that the entropy of a black hole can never decrease when you look at it from the point of view of quantum mechanics, and or that in classical general relativity, and Professor Polchinski will tell you how it may decrease, however, in quantum theory. Okay. I trust you'll tell him all these things. Pardon? Yeah. Okay, let me just very quickly, as time is flying, talk about what goes on inside a black hole. Inside of a black hole, there is a singularity. That singularity is a region where the space-time warpage becomes extremely strong. The physical manifestation of the space-time warpage is a stretching and squeezing of space and of everything that resides in space, stretching and squeezing that is called tidal gravitational forces, because it's a similar to but enormously stronger than the gravitational force of the moon and the sun that raise the tides on the surface of the Earth, on the Earth's oceans and on the solid Earth. If I fall into this black hole, as I near the singularity, I experience this tidal gravitational force near the singularity that will stretch me from head to foot, squeeze me from the sides. Then a moment later, it will stretch me from the sides and squeeze me from head to foot, and I get stretched and squeezed in an oscillatory manner, faster and faster and faster, until I die. The atoms of which my body is made get stretched and squeezed faster and faster in an oscillatory manner until they are destroyed or transmuted beyond anything that we can imagine. And space and time get stretched, or space gets stretched and squeezed in an oscillatory manner until it ceases to resemble anything we would recognize as space, and then Professor Polchinski takes over. Okay. Well, let me briefly talk about gravitational waves. In the real universe, a imploding star will... In the real universe, an imploding star will not be spherical. It will not be precisely flattened in the manner of a spinning black hole. It will have lumps on it. It will have a lot of chaos inside it. And as a result, for example, if you had a little lump on the surface of the imploding star in this space-time diagram, the black hole's horizon would form with a lump on it. Now, the black hole horizon does not like to have lumps. It wants to smooth itself out and become very quickly a horizon governed by Kerr's equations, a horizon that has all of the properties I talked about. And so it has to lose that lump in some manner, and what happens is that the ripples in the fabric of space-time, ripples of curvature, go flying out and flying in. Some of the ripples going down to the singularity, some of the ripples going off into the distant universe. And they carry away the distortion of the gravitational field, the lump in the space-time curvature. So in a picture showing the star with a lump that grows, a black hole horizon and gravitational waves, ripples in the fabric of space-time flying off, and the lump dies out, and you have a nice, smooth black hole of the Kerr sort. How fast does that happen? 20 microseconds for a one-solar mass black hole. I mean, very fast in the same characteristic time or some multiple of it. If you have two black holes going around each other, a small black hole, say, going around a large black hole, it will emit ripples of curvature in the surrounding space, and those ripples will travel out then as gravitational waves as this small black hole orbits around and around and ultimately goes through the horizon of the large black hole. Those ripples then will carry information about the curvature of space-time in the vicinity of the big black hole, information that is put into them by the small black hole, into these gravitational waves as the small black hole goes around. And so one of the challenges of the next few years, as Professor Blanford will describe, is the challenge to detect these gravitational waves and to extract from them a map, a high-precision map, in fact, of the warpage of space-time of the big black hole as encoded in those gravitational waves. The nature of those waves as they go through this room is that they consist of a stretching and squeezing of space. First a stretch horizontally, if they're going from me toward you, and a squeeze vertically. A moment later, a stretch vertically, a squeeze horizontally, an oscillatory stretch and squeeze. There are two polarizations. One has stretch and squeeze axes like that, so it's called a plus polarization. The other has stretch and squeeze axes like this, so it's called a cross polarization. And we expect in this field, within a few years, to be measuring both waveforms, the details of the oscillatory stretches and squeezes produced by the gravitational waves, and that we expect then to be able to extract from these long wave trains the detailed maps of the space-time curvature of the large black hole that are generated by the small black hole spiraling in. Of greater interest, in fact, is going to be when we have two big black holes that are formed in the form of a binary system that are orbiting around each other that merge and coalesce. This is particularly interesting because each black hole drags space into a tornado-like motion around its horizon. And the orbital motion also has angular momentum, and the angular momentum of the orbital motion drags space into a tornado-like motion in the vicinity of the two black holes. And so what we have is two tornadoes that will typically be spinning about different axes, embedded in a larger tornado as they go around each other. They come crashing together, and there is violent oscillations, violent and highly nonlinear oscillations in the fabric of space and time in that merger. Oscillations and behaviors of warped space-time that we don't know the details of. There are major efforts to simulate this on supercomputers and try to understand what should be the detailed behavior of space-time warpage in this kind of a merger in order to compare with the observations. I have a bet with the leaders of the supercomputer simulations that we, doing gravitational wave detection, will see these waves before they can do successful simulations on supercomputers. In practice, what we expect is to go back and forth between the observations and the theory to understand, by mixed observation and supercomputer simulation, how space-time warpage behaves in the most violent of oscillations that it can undergo. So that is sort of looking toward the future when we will be studying for the first time highly dynamical black holes and how they behave as they try to settle down into the final curse state where they're governed by the beautiful, very simple formulas. Well, I think I should stop this discussion at this point. I've run out of time, fortunately, just before I was going to talk about naked singularities, wormholes, and time travel. After all, this workshop is on black holes and not on those topics. But let me conclude by alluding to those topics in the following way. It is a real challenge for theoretical physics to understand whether naked singularities can exist, that is, singularities that are not inside a black hole, not hidden by a black hole horizon. It's a real challenge to understand whether the laws of physics permit wormholes, where you could enter the mouth of a wormhole here and emerge very quickly out through the mouth of the worm, another mouth of the wormhole elsewhere in the universe or in some other universe. It's a real challenge to understand whether an infinitely advanced civilization could build a time machine to travel backward in time. We've already seen that a sufficiently advanced civilization could go forward in time as fast as they want by going down near the horizon of a black hole, but backward in time. Those are interesting and important challenges in our efforts to understand the laws of physics more deeply. The handwriting is on the wall that the answers to these questions is probably no, no, no. That the laws of physics probably forbid naked singularities traversable wormholes and backward time travel. But if that's the answer, we would like to understand deeply why and how those things are forbidden. If the handwriting on the wall is being misread, we would also like to understand that. But those phenomena are radically different from black holes. You look at the theory of black holes and you are driven inexorably to the conclusion that they have to exist in the real universe. You look at the theories of these other things and you are driven very strongly to the tentative conclusion that they're forbidden. Nevertheless, these are two, all of these things are solutions to Einstein's equations. And there is a fundamental issue of understanding then how it is that the other laws of nature combined with Einstein's equations rule out these exotica I was talking about. And how is it that the combination of all the laws of nature, including general relativity, insists that black holes exist? So that is a theoretical enterprise that I and other people have been involved in when we study wormholes, naked singularities, and time machines, is trying to sort that out. A very important theoretical enterprise, but something where the black holes sit by themselves as the one kind of exotica that there is essentially no question they're really there, and the other exotica are getting driven further and further away from likely existence by these studies as the studies go more and more deep. Thank you.
Kip and indeed all the speakers today will be available throughout the day, including during the present refreshment break and at lunch as well. And I think just to keep the thing going on time, and we want to get the next talk started at 11 o'clock, why don't we go ahead and break for refreshments, and if we just go through this door.